The power of the people. It's kind of a popular theme right now, from populist uprisings to crowdfunding to social media amplifying conversations and ultimately crossing over into business decisions. I'm Molly Wood, in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Lizzie is on the road this week, reporting from Corvallis, Oregon, and we'll be hearing from her throughout the show. We'll take on the invocation of Article 50 and the potential impact of Brexit on international trade, and of course, on the people who voted for and against it. Plus, we're looking at the power of the superfan, the importance of Instagram to the changing economics of flowers, and what it means for humans when machines have the power to predict our deaths. As always, you can reach out to the show on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Let's start the show with some long and short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And we ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. This week, Lizzie checked in with two of our regular guests, Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Marketplace Senior Reporter Kimberly Adams in Washington, D.C. Take it away, team.
So you all have longs and shorts that kind of go together this week from both the realms of work and the realms of politics and government. So, Kimberly, why don't you start us off with your long?
I am long on workplace microaggressions because we saw two of them that were pretty high profile this week, although I guess if they're high profile, they're no longer microaggressions. Here in D.C., we had White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer telling a White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Network's April Ryan. He told her to stop shaking her head at him during the press briefing. And then Fox News host Bill O'Reilly was making fun of Congresswoman Maxine Waters because of her wig. And it prompted this hashtag, Black Women at Work, that I think many different underrepresented groups could relate to about just the different things that people say and do in the workplace that maybe aren't outright racist, but are condescending or diminishing in some way. And on the one hand, watching that discussion was very good because it's good that people are talking about it. But on the other hand, for me as a Black woman, watching all of these people listing all of these microaggressions that they face on a regular basis was pretty darn depressing.
I did have moments of, wow, I'm fascinated by this conversation, and other kind of like, whoa, what?
Yeah, I had kind of a similar reaction to Kimberly. It brought up a lot of things that have happened in the past at work as a Black woman that kind of made me shake my head or feel uncomfortable. I think it's one of these situations where, you know, women at work, especially women of color at work, have been told for so long that to fit in or to get ahead, there's just some stuff that they're going to have to take and deal with and be quiet about. And it's really kind of a different feeling having everyone come together and talk about it.
One of the things that jumped out at me in particular about this was, not even if you were a member of Congress, not even if you are a correspondent in the White House press corps, are you immune from these microaggressions that women and people of color and other people from underrepresented groups face on a regular basis. There's just no buffer.
Kimberly, you sent an interesting piece of research our way that was looking at the financial breakdown kind of beneath a lot of the stories that we were hearing and looking at pay gaps. We know, obviously, that women make less than men. But the numbers that you sent me cited that Black women who work full time earn 63 cents on the dollar for every dollar that a white man earns.
And when you're facing these sort of workplace environments where people are belittling you even without meaning to, or letting you know in some way that you are less than, it makes it harder to advocate for the better salary. It makes it harder to prove your worth and say, this is why I deserve to make more.
Jillian, I want to turn to your long because I think it goes with this discussion and it scopes it out to look at a bunch of big employers.
Yeah, absolutely. So this week I'm long the phrase, we need to do better. That particular phrase comes from the Uber diversity report, which came out this week. And it showed that while diversity at Uber had gotten better, as they said, we need to do better, that there were lots of improvements to make. So I think this is something that as we pay more attention to diversity in the workplace, that we're going to keep hearing this idea that there's been progress made, but things need to get better. And I find that both edifying and frustrating because on the one hand, and it expresses this continued commitment to doing better. On the other hand, it just seems like an excuse occasionally and a little bit of a placeholder to say, oh, well, things have gotten a little better, not much, but don't worry, we need to do better. And, you know, we're going to do that some undetermined time in the future.
It's also frustrating because rarely does that come along with here's what better looks like. Because saying that we need to do better, like, what does better look like to you? Does better look like having 5 people of color in your workplace of 100 people? Or does it look like having 30 people of color plus open conversations about why diverse hiring hasn't been happening and what's behind that?
So women make up about 36% of their workforce. About half the employees there identify as white. Uber actually did better than, say, Google or Apple. Google noted that women made up about 31% of its workforce and that about 59% of its employees identify as white. So, we do have, certainly from big companies, some metrics that either they can be held accountable to by themselves, their shareholders, the public, et cetera. But Kimberly, you're raising the question of like, okay, well, then what?
I wonder, better than what? What were you trying? What was the strategy? And what are the ways in which it failed? What are you going to implement now? I feel like a more comprehensive conversation about what we are attempting, what has failed, what we are tweaking, and then the ability to, for at least employees, to give feedback on that or have a real conversation about why they think it didn't work or what might.
You know, we did a big series on shareholder value. David Brancaccio really took the lead on that. And one of the questions is, do shareholders value a more inclusive and diverse workforce, or do they just value a bottom line? Do they value a return on a stock price?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to shift us a little bit now from the world of work to the world of government and policy a little bit. Again, you both have these two things that sort of go together. Kimberly, give us your short.
I am going to go short on the government shutdown. We hear over and over again, oh my gosh, we're facing this government shutdown because the debt ceiling is coming and Congress isn't working nicely together. And how on earth are they going to work things out beforehand? April 28th is a deadline to pass legislation funding the government through the end of September. And every single time we come up against these deadlines, it's, oh, we're going to have a government shutdown. And what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And we haven't had a government shutdown in a really long time. Why is that? Because it was deadly for the party in charge the last time that happened. It is politically helpful to absolutely no one to have your name attached to a government shutdown.
Right. And it's also just super dumb. It's a super dumb move. It's like the slowest moving game of chicken ever. Like, at some point, just move out of the way. It's horrific to watch.
And if you want to know how desperate they are to avoid a government shutdown, House Speaker Paul Ryan has said that they're even leaving Planned Parenthood defunding off of this because that is so polarizing that they don't even want to deal with it this time.
That sends the signal that, look, we just want to keep the government open and try and move forward. Speaking of moving forward, one of the things they want to do, Jillian, you are short on.
I am short on comprehensive tax reform. I'm not sure if you guys heard, governing is super duper hard.
Turns
and
out.
So the GOP seems to think that's going to be easier to pass comprehensive tax reform than it was to pass health care. But tax reform is a bear of an issue. That's why no one has done a comprehensive tax reform since Reagan.
Even the Heritage Foundation is sending out, you know, news releases saying, FYI, guys, this isn't easy. And the Heritage Foundation is a very conservative think tank. We got new numbers about the national debt and that it's going to explode to 150% of our economic output by 2047 unless we change. On the one hand, tax reform is really, really hard. But on the other hand, especially because we have a Congress led by fiscal conservatives, it has to be done.
Comprehensive tax reform takes bipartisan commitment. It takes actual governing and cooperation. It takes a lot of time. As my colleague Derek wrote this week, the GOP had 7 years to prepare for the ACA repeal, and they gave up actually trying to get it done in fewer than 20 days. So if that's how they're handling tax reform, that's not going to get done. I think the thing that they can do to please their base and reaffirm this commitment to changing taxes is to simply implement a similar Bush-style tax cut that isn't going to be legacy-making by any means, by any stretch. It's going to last for, you know, maybe another 10 years, and then it'll expire.
Yeah, but when you give people things from the federal government, it becomes really hard to take them back. Case in point, ACA.
That is absolutely true. And I think for sure that we shouldn't act like a tax cut is nothing. But I think in comparison to the high-minded ideals that tax reform has and that the administration came in with, it is certainly a completely different beat.
Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, Jillian White from The Atlantic, thank you both so much.
You're welcome, Lizzie.
Bye, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, and if you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Raghu Manavalan and Sarah Menendez as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. And our first number is...
$16 billion.
That's the amount taxpayers would save each year if the U.S. stopped producing pennies, cut back on nickel production, and moved to a $1 coin.
This week, Republican Senators John McCain and Mike Enzi introduced the measure called the Coins Act.
Senator Enzi says that switching to a $1 coin would save the country $150 million a year.
So if we stop using pennies, does this mean they'll become a collector item and be worth more than just a cent?
I like where your head's at.
5.9%
is the increase in home prices year over year as of January. It's a 31-month high for the housing market.
So what's behind this boom?
Among other reasons, millennials. They're the largest demographic group, and they've been buying homes later in life.
Plus, with the forecast for increased interest rates in the future, consumers might be getting while the getting's good.
2,600.
That's about the number of pages that the U.S. federal tax code actually is.
That number comes from Andrew Grossman, a tax attorney on Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation.
This week, the Republican-controlled House Ways and Means Committee tweeted that the tax code was 70,000 pages, a number that's often cited.
That's a 67,400-page difference. So where'd they get such a large page count from?
It turns out that some estimates include things like past tax statutes and IRS regulations and rulings on top of the current codes. So when you look at it like that, the page numbers add up fast.
And I mean, as anyone who's ever had to write a term paper knows, it all really just depends on your font size.
Totally.
Earlier this week, British Prime Minister Theresa May invoked Article 50. That kicks off the formal separation of Britain from the European Union. Brexit, of course, touched off huge debates within the UK and the EU. In Scotland, which voted heavily to remain in the European Union, the decision is so unpopular that it sparked a new campaign for Scottish independence from Britain. Europe has to navigate a rough path forward for renegotiating trade deals with the UK, and the Brits have to cut a deal good enough to justify the whole exit in the first place. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins me to discuss the way forward. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Molly.
So Brexit has begun. Britain is headed for the long walk to the exit, I suppose. What happens next?
What always happens, Molly, at times of crisis and drama and upheaval in the European Union? Nothing. Or at least nothing much for at least a month while the 27 remaining member states get their act together and agree on their negotiating stance. Formal talks won't begin until probably late May, and the really hard bargaining won't start until after the German election in September. Then the parties will have about a year to hammer out an agreement. That will be put to a vote by the 27 remaining states and the European and the UK parliaments. All in time, it's hoped, for the deadline of March 29th, 2019, when Britain should be out of the EU with or without a deal.
Now, you say without a deal, but there's going to be a deal, right? I mean, it feels like it is in everyone's interests to get an amicable arrangement. Is all of this buildup really just toward an inevitability?
Well, you'd think it's in everybody's interests. I mean, that would be certainly the rational assumption, but this is a divorce,
right,
which is not always a rational process. I mean, the Europeans are saying already that the Brits want their cake and want to eat it too.
Mm-hmm.
They want a free trade deal with the EU without any of the burdens of EU membership, like loss of sovereignty, like free movement, which brings mass immigration into the UK. But from the EU's point of view, I mean, they don't want Britain to be seen waltzing off with a great deal that might encourage other member states to consider leaving too. But the first big stumbling block, money, as the lugubrious Donald Tusk, head of the European Council, has just made clear.
We will also need to make sure that the UK honours all financial commitments and liabilities it has taken as a member state.
Now, the Brits wanted the divorce bill that Mr. Tusk is talking about. They decided at the same time as everything else, giving them a bit of leverage over a possible trade deal. But Mr. Tusk has said, no, we want the money agreed up front before we agree any trade deal.
Well, now, you know, we should get to the numbers. How much money are we talking about here? How much does Tusk and the EU want?
Well, the not inconsiderable figure of $64 billion has been mentioned. Is the equivalent. Yeah. I mean, that's the eye-watering equivalent of 6 years of net contributions by the UK. So, in other words, the UK leaves the club but carries on paying the membership fees for another 6 years. I mean, politically, very difficult, if not impossible, for any UK government to agree.
How much pressure is there on Britain? Because at the end of the day, the UK may be leaving the EU, but trying to keep the UK together, right? There's talk that the entire United Kingdom could break up over this.
Well, it is perfectly possible because of Scotland. I mean, in the EU referendum last year, the Scottish people voted 60-40 in favour of staying in the EU. Now, the Scottish National Party, which runs the devolved government in Edinburgh and wants Scotland to separate from the UK, has seized on Brexit as a pretext to call another referendum on Scottish independence. In the UK Parliament, just after triggering Brexit, PM Theresa May again said, no, absolutely not. We're not allowing another Scottish referendum while we've got our hands full with Brexit. This is what she said, and you can hear the reaction of Scottish lawmakers as she says it.
Now is not the time to be talking about a second independence referendum. On today of all days, we should be coming together as a united kingdom to get the best deal for Britain.
Wow.
Yeah. Doesn't sound to me much like unity, does it?
Not a good day. No. Does that increase the pressure on Britain and PM May to make a good deal?
It does, although the government has said this does not represent any pressure at all. We have to respect the wishes of the British, of the whole country, not just the people that voted to remain in the EU, but the whole country and the majority in the whole country did vote to leave. So the British government says we're going to put off, postpone any second referendum on Scottish independence until well after Brexit has been done and dusted. And then we are prepared to have it put to the Scottish people. Do you want to stay in or do you want to leave?
We can guess the mood of the Scottish people, but what is the general mood in the country?
Well, the country is split, not down the middle, but it is divided, as it was at the time of the EU referendum, into leavers and remainers. Listen to this man, Lord O'Donnell, formerly the most senior civil servant in the UK. He says Britain is now embarking on a hair-raising departure.
We are in a plane being flown by members of the EU and we're about to jump out and we've got a parachute that was designed by the people flying the plane. And they've designed it in a way to deter anybody else jumping out.
And then you've got the leavers who say, don't worry, we'll be fine. And anyway, even if there is in the short term some economic disruption, we'll be free. Here's Nigel Farage, former head of the UK Independence Party, which campaigned for Brexit.
There'll be arguments over the next 2 years about trade deals and fishing rights. But actually, the big thing is 2 years from now, we're going to be an independent, self-governing nation. And I couldn't be happier.
So for him and for out-and-out Brexiters, this is a bold move, a brave, exhilarating move. But for others, it's a terrifying leap into the unknown.
That's Marketplace's Stephen Beard from the European Desk. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Molly.
To listen to technologists talk, you'd think we're approaching a point where computers pretty soon are going to know everything. Learning machines are sucking up vast amounts of data and using algorithms to uncover patterns and sometimes make predictions. In the world of healthcare, those data sets are our medical histories, and some of the things the machines can predict include when we might die, especially if we're already sick. But it turns out that in healthcare, this isn't a scary thing. Dr. Ziad Obermeyer is an emergency room doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. He studies how machine learning can help doctors treat patients with serious illnesses. Ziad, thanks for being here.
No, thanks so much for having me.
So back at the beginning of your research, you were an ER doctor. You saw that it was difficult for doctors to tell patients that they might die. But do you feel like this was a communication problem or a prognostication problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people working on the communication side. In other words, how doctors should bring up the subject of death and dying to patients. I think that the prerequisite for that is that the doctors actually need to know about it beforehand. And right. There's a lot of research suggesting that doctors are just not very good at predicting death. That's, I think, the impetus for a lot of my work, is that machines can see the world and can see patients in ways that we cannot as doctors, and can start helping us with some of these difficult predictions that we would like to make in our clinical practice, but just don't have the ability to.
What are the benefits? It sounds like there are many. What are the benefits of knowing when someone is going to die, of being able to predict that fairly accurately?
Yeah, I think there are some direct benefits to patients. There are a lot of surveys that have been done of people who are living with serious illnesses that are life-limiting. And one thing that those patients really, really want and aren't getting from doctors is objective predictions about how long they have to live. Doctors are very reluctant to answer those kinds of questions, partly because, you know, you don't want to be wrong about something so important, but also mm-hmm. partly because there's a sense that patients don't want to know. And in fact, that turns out not to be true when you actually ask the patients. People do want to know because it helps them to put their affairs in order, both kind of logistically and emotionally, and make all the arrangements that need to be made.
In the article you co-authored for the New England Journal of Medicine, you wrote that AI or the machine learning could disrupt the healthcare industry, especially imaging and radiology. Will machine learning be for radiologists what automation was or is for manufacturing?
I think there are very big changes coming to medicine, and I think it's going to have a lot of implications. First, for the kinds of doctors that are, in essence, translating things from digital pictures to digital reports, because that translation can now increasingly be done by a machine. And so I think increasingly over the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to see a lot of that work being displaced by machines. There's always going to be a place for humans. In other words, we still have pilots flying planes, even though we have autopilot. But I think it's going to change the industry quite a bit as those technologies come online.
Well, yeah, now we're talking about in the context of palliative care. How much longer do you think it's going to be before one of these machines can predict a relatively healthy person's death?
I think it's all part of the same algorithm. I think we, for example, use a lot of the data from the Harvard hospital systems. Those data cover a lot of young patients just as well as old patients, and the algorithm performs just as well across all age groups, genders, races. And so when you have the data and you have a well-measured outcome like death, predicting anyone's likelihood of death in the next year is pretty easy.
Would you want to know?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think it's a little scary, but it's hard to turn down knowledge when you're given the option of knowing.
Ziad Obermeyer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you're active on Instagram or Pinterest, there's something you may have noticed there a lot. Flowers. And florists. And I'm not talking about your standard bouquet, like some red roses or brightly colored daisies. These modern and digitally popular arrangements are lush and wild. Some of them feel like a pre-Raphaelite painting. And this aesthetic has serious business implications for the global floral industry. Deborah Needleman wrote about it for Tea Magazine, and she spoke to Lizzie O'Leary.
So let's say that you send me a modern floral arrangement like the ones that you have written about. Can you describe what it looks like to me?
Yes. So the contemporary florists have kind of opened up the vocabulary of what you can put into a flower arrangement. So it can be anything from herbs, vegetables, weeds, but also really beautiful garden flowers. things from the roadside. They've really opened up what is beautiful and what is acceptable to be in a flower arrangement.
What's behind this change? You know, how did we go from my kind of old-fashioned understanding, you know, a box of red roses, to these wild and kind of Shakespearean-looking arrangements?
They are quite wild, these new arrangements. And it's interesting because I think it's a sort of powerful movement that has the potential to change the floral industry, but it really happened by accident. The proponents of this movement are largely women and largely young women, and almost all of the ones I've spoken to started off in the floristry industry because they had a friend getting married and they offered to do the flowers. And then a friend of a friend, and someone saw it, and the next thing they knew, they had a business. And these are really sort of young women who are looking to kind of have meaningful lives and live a bit closer to nature. And they've really come into the business by accident, but are actually sort of taking it by storm and transforming it.
At the same time, it seems like there's a change in sort of the, I guess you could say, supply chain going on here, that we're not talking about, you know, at least in this movement, mass-produced flowers that are moved from one continent to another. It's different.
Exactly. And it's really comparable to what happened with the food movement. It's really the same idea. And obviously, local flowers grown without loads of toxic pesticides and fungicides isn't perhaps as important as food because we don't ingest flowers. But similarly, it means that we're using flowers that are grown in America, so we're creating more agricultural land and jobs and decent wages. And most interestingly, to me, we're using flowers that are simply more beautiful, that are tied to a season and a place and are more fragrant. Because one of the interesting things about shipping flowers around the world is in order for a flower to be able to be shipped for a week in a box and live outside of water, they are bred to be very long-lasting. And fragrance is really the first thing that goes, because if you think about it, it's sort of metabolically taxing on a flower to create fragrance. So it's quite analogous to the food movement.
What is the role of Instagram in all of this?
Instagram has really been able to transform the industry because people see how pretty it is. And so there's that kind of lifestyle envy that has drawn so many people into the industry. But more importantly, it has the power to make a trend take hold and to change the market. Because before, things would happen in isolation and you could have a trend, but it wouldn't be so widespread. And now, because the florists and the farmers are working together, they can change a trend so quickly and change the marketplace. So if an influential florist uses a, say, rusty-colored ranunculus, which is a sort of trendy flower of the moment, they can have their flower farmer grow them, and they can create instant demand for it. So it's really just exponentially changed the market.
You know, when we talk about the people doing this, you're saying they are mostly women. They seem to me to be largely kind of white millennial women in this very specific bit of culture. Does this translate beyond them, or is it still sort of a niche thing?
I think that's a really good question. And it is really true that, unfortunately, at this moment, it is a very sort of white trend. And I think it is quite small. I mean, we're looking at the imported flower industry is a $7 or $8 billion industry. And the locally or American grown flower industry is a $500 million a year industry. And it still really is in its infant stages. So it really is about weddings and big events. And I think the next step is where it broadens out into not just flower arrangements, but the flowers that we buy at our supermarkets. And it becomes a much broader, less kind of elitist phenomenon.
Deborah Needleman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here at Marketplace Weekend, we like to ask people in the spotlight questions about work, money, and the lessons they've learned along the way. It's called the Marketplace Quiz. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest. And also, if you're listening with kids, there's some slightly adult language ahead.
Who am I? I'm Neil Brennan. I'm a comedian, a writer, and director.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
It never ends. It's never over. You're never off. You always have to be. You're always behind. Like, you know, I should be writing right now instead of doing this. I should be coming up with jokes right now. The clock's always running. I have, you know, it's like my peers are out creating material.
That sounds really stressful.
It's stressful, yeah. It sucks. Jokes come from out of nowhere, so you don't know when it's going to be. You always have to have your, like, hip waders on.
Oh, man.
You're always in the river, that's my point. In the stream, like Dick Cheney.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
A gold tooth? I don't completely regret it. It just got, like, burnished. It looks awful. And it didn't look great in my mouth. I should have gotten, like, platinum, which I may still get. Because I'm an idiot and I don't have kids or a wife or even so much as a girlfriend. I couldn't even put that together. But I don't regret it. It had fun. It's just hard to resell a gold tooth. It's hard to go like, hey, you know, what are the odds? It's going to fit someone's canine. And then I've had some bad experiences with designing my own shoes on Nike ID. I'm just not, I don't have any talent for it. You think you're going to be the best, and then you do it, and you're like, oh, I don't. The mistake that guys do, and a lot of people do with any sort of fashion thing, is they do too much.
Mm-hmm.
Most guys don't know the Coco Chanel thing of, like, take one accessory out. When you're designing a shoe, you don't want to underdo it, because why not just buy it off the rack? So then you overdo it, and you go like, yeah, camouflage and neon should work, right? No.
Not sure in reality. Don't.
Anyone lives in California near Venice and wants to get a pair of camouflage and neon green Nikes, you let me know.
What is your most prized possession?
I'm disappointingly not very materialistic. Like, the only thing of value in my house is my computer.
Hmm.
And that probably is probably not, I bought it 3-4 years ago, so the value is probably not what it was. So, like, everyone's so worried about getting broken into it. It's like, what do you have of value? I don't have any jewels. I don't have a chain. I don't have any ear. Like, I don't have any rings.
Uh-huh. It doesn't have to be a material.
No, I know, but I don't want to get, like, my sense of fairness is my most prized possession. I don't know. I like things that remind me of things that I've, like, I have a bunch of shirts and shoes and sweatshirts from Nike, and I got them for free because I direct commercials for Nike sometimes.
Is this a casual ad for Nike?
Yes.
Right now?
Nike, just do it. So I'm proud of the fact that I direct commercials for Nike because I think it's cool and I think they're a great company and I love the commercials. So it reminds me, like, yeah, you've done well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like a Letterman's jacket that no one knows I'm wearing.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
I wish someone had told me to, like, thoroughly investigate things and only work with people that you really, really care about. And no, a lot of work situations are like roommate situations where you don't know until it's too late. And then you're like, oh no, you leave pubes in the sink or whatever. The work version of that.
Like, what's the work version of that?
It's pubes in a shower instead of a sink. No, the work version of that is just like, oh, you don't respect me or you don't really trust me or you don't. We have very different sensibilities and very different ideas about stuff. So now I'm, like, super cautious and do almost nothing that isn't just, like, self-generated.
Hmm. How long do you think it took you to realize that?
I mean, there were a few of them, but it's hard. You think, like, oh, let me just try. Let me get out of. I was talking to somebody yesterday about, like, getting out of your comfort zone is often a bad idea. Don't get out of your comfort zone. It's your comfort zone for a reason. It's also, like, known as your wheelhouse. So, like, what? Get out of your. Why? My job kind of requires some comfort. So, like, the idea of stepping out of your comfort zone is like, yeah, if you want to be bad.
So stay in your comfort zone.
Stay in your comfort zone. Yeah, that's what I said.
You can catch Neil Brennan's stand-up special, Three Mics, on Netflix now. Earlier in the show, we talked about how individuals are changing the floral industry. Now, we're going to look at the power that individuals and groups of individuals have in all types of businesses. In this case, I'm talking about the fans. Back in 2011, a group of Polaroid fans got upset when the company stopped making instant film. So they set out to create their own. They called it Impossible Film, and their endeavor was known as the Impossible Project. And it wasn't impossible, but it was hard. The project asked people who love instant photography to test out really terrible film and give their input, and ultimately help create better instant film. That is the power of the fan. And the Impossible Project is one of many such stories told in a new book called Super Fandom by Zoe Fraud-Blenar and Aaron M. Glazer. Lizzie sat down with Zoe to discuss the book, and Zoe explained what exactly a fan is and how it's actually very different than being a consumer.
We used to think that fans were people who just liked something a lot. And we now know that's not the case. Being a fan is active. It requires participating in a set of activities that show that you're more than just someone who likes something. So if I like Tide with bleach and I use it all the time, then that's great and I'm a loyal consumer. But if I start going onto message boards and telling people about it and perhaps writing them letters and advocating for them to change the color, now I'm starting to get into the area of fandom. Being a fan is active. It's a verb.
You know, you say in this book that fans are not consumers, and yet this seems so inextricably linked to capitalism. I mean, we're talking in many cases about products.
Fandom is at heart a form of marketing, which is, it's kind of a dystopian way of thinking about this thing, which is so personal to so many people. But if we want to break it down to its core commercial purpose, it is this externally generated branding. It's a form of marketing that doesn't change the fact that it's a very important and personal thing that it's doing for people. It's doing very valid cultural work, and that doesn't in any way invalidate how people feel about it.
I mean, I guess we see that in sort of the growth of, say, Comic-Con, but then how major movie studios, you know, also bring their stars to Comic-Con, that it's sort of, I mean, is it co-opting fandom in that way?
It is. Fans are smart. Fans can usually tell when they're being used. There's a general concept in non-fans that fans can't possibly understand that they're being used. No, fans understand. Fans choose to overlook the commercial implications of what they're doing as long as it still suits their needs. You can definitely believe that the second that they're not getting what they want out of their loyalty, they certainly won't do it anymore.
Yeah, that brings us to this sort of idea of when fans are displeased. Tell me about what happened with Maker's Mark.
Ah, Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark Bourbon. They had a business imperative where they needed to step up production quickly. That's a problem for Maker's Mark because it does take 6 years, or at least 6 years, for them to age their bourbon enough for it to be ready for market. So they made the decision that they were going to water it down just very slightly. This wouldn't change the taste because having a higher alcohol content actually dulls the taste buds. And taking a page from standard social media practices, they said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to tell the fans. We're going to be as transparent as possible. And by being transparent, we'll be able to get by them. It didn't work out that way. They told
the
fans.
No, it did not.
The fans lost it. They were extremely unhappy about this. Fans are conservative. They stifle change. They don't like anything that might change the meaning of that relationship that they have with the fan object. That's not to say that fan input isn't useful. It is. It's wonderful. But fans want more of the same. They don't want to risk this thing that they love so much in any kind of change, even change that's necessary to the survival of this thing that they love, is very, very scary. And in this case, the fans of Maker Mark, they wrote hate mail, they disrupted events, They certainly flooded all the social media channels. In fact, to the point where a week later, the following Sunday, Maker's Mark did, in fact, roll back its change.
Which is, it's just amazing to me to think this, you know, major company said, we're sorry. I mean, I'm actually looking at, you know, what they wrote, which is, we're sincerely sorry we let you down.
Yeah, this is very interesting. If you actually look at the social media buzz, it had peaked the previous Tuesday. So there is a question now, did Maker's Mark do the right thing? We may never know, but it's certainly true that studies have now found that small groups of very angry people on the internet can seem like a much bigger presence than they actually are. So this is called the majority illusion. It's a small group of extremists can very quickly and easily skew the conversation. It's very possible that this anger and outrage over the alcohol content of Maker's Mark was actually only held by a very small group of fans.
Well, so then how should businesses think about their fans, their super fans? Because on the one hand, it seems like they're, you know, the people who are going to buy the Star Wars tickets on presale. But on the other hand, if they can, you know, torpedo a brand's business plan, that's a real risk.
Fan concerns, they need to be taken seriously. They should not be taken literally. When fans are rebelling, when there's an uprising like this, it needs to be taken as a sign of fear. The fans want to be reassured that their emotional investment is still safe, that you still care about them, that you hear them, that you're not ignoring them. It's very important not to necessarily do exactly what they need, though, because fans don't necessarily know what's best for the product. They certainly know what's best for the audience. And they may know that fan object better than the owners itself do, but they can't run a business. And that's an important distinction to make.
Zoe Fraud-Blanar is the co-author with Aaron Glazer of Super Fandom. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Across the country, the demand for low-income housing far exceeds the supply. Now, in the Trump administration, that market might become even tighter. Over the past 30 years, investors have taken advantage of something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program to create millions of units of affordable housing. But if corporate tax reform happens, that means investors would see lower tax bills overall, and that in turn could make those tax credits much less appealing. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
It's a frigid 30 degrees out, but construction at Portner Flats Apartments in Washington, D.C. is moving full speed ahead.
There'll be 96 units here, all of them financed with the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program.
Bill Whitman is a partner with Somerset Development, which owns this building. In a city where the cost of rent is rising exponentially, this project will be reserved for families making below AMI, or the area median income. Compare that with another construction site across the street.
The average rents in that building are expected to be $5.38 a square foot, whereas the rents for the affordable units in this project will be $1.75 a square foot.
Did you catch that? These apartments will be rented more than three times below the market rate. This is possible because the credits awarded to investors allow a dollar-for-dollar credit against their federal taxes in exchange for funding affordable housing. Without the credits, Whitman says regular people could never afford to live here.
The Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program is critical, is essential. It's the but-for in projects like this. Without it, this doesn't happen.
But if you cut corporate tax rates from 35% down to 20 or 15, as President Trump wants to do, you also cut the demand for a credit.
We've already seen the prospect of tax reform have a meaningful impact on the price that investors are willing to pay.
Paul Weissman directs affordable housing lending for the Hunt Mortgage Group. He says investors are already valuing credits 15 to 20% lower, and if you factor in rising interest rates, which makes lending even more costly, the overall impact
is potentially much more because you have projects that are no longer viable that before were viable.
Currently, some 100,000 new units of affordable housing come onto the market nationally each year. Unfortunately, it's nowhere near enough, says David Godshalk of Telesis.
The challenge is that this is coming at a time when demand for affordable housing, particularly demand for housing for very low-income families, is growing.
Telesis is a developer specializing in affordable housing projects in urban areas. Since the Great Recession, Godshalk says rents have risen much faster than incomes, creating a supply shortage of around 4 million units.
As an example, if we build 100,000 units of tax credit housing every year, even if we were to double that, we could build at that pace for the next 20 years and still not fill the current gap.
If tax credit values tank, that means projects would need to find some kind of gap financing. Another solution is just to sell more credits.
If we would put more credit into the marketplace, more of those projects could be built.
Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell and Republican Orrin Hatch have drafted a legislative solution called the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, which aims to expand funding for the tax credit program by 50%, or perhaps less.
Maybe if we're out there on the Senate floor and somebody said, oh, how about 30, and we could get it done, you know, we might end up at a different point. But I definitely think you can justify the demand for this.
Cantwell says the act would create or preserve around 1.3 million affordable homes over 10 years and build another 400,000 more than is possible under the current program. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
And that is our show. Thank you to Oregon Public Broadcasting for their production help this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe and Brian Allison are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I am Molly Wood. Lizzie will be back next week. Thanks for listening. This is APM.